Welcome to everyone to Nadia Bolz-Weber's talk today about, is it about being radical loyalists or loyal radicals? Something like that. Nadia is here from Denver, Colorado, and it's been my delight over the last few years to come to know Nadia and to love her deeply. She's a pastor, founding pastor of the House for All Sinners and Saints in Denver, an evangelical Lutheran Church of America pastor, checking I've got my language right, and author of a fantastic book called Salvation on the Small Screen, 24 Hours of Christian Television, which is both wise, witty, and incredibly clever and sensitive and beautiful. Nadia will be signing copies of her book after this morning's talk over in G Books, and it's well worth a read, I think. So, Nadia, welcome, and really looking forward to what you have to say to us today.
Good morning. Did you guys sleep last night, or you just came straight here from the party? Yeah? Well, my name's Nadia Bolz-Weber. As she said, I'm the founding pastor of a Lutheran emerging church in Denver, Colorado. It's called House for All Sinners and Saints. There's actually eight of us here from the church. We led a liturgy a couple nights ago, which was big fun. It's an honor to be here and to talk to you this morning. I think the easiest way to get into this conversation is to do a brief autobiography, if you'll indulge me, so it can kind of make sense how I got here from there. I was raised in a very sectarian, fundamentalist form of the church. It's called Church of Christ. They believed they were the only people going to heaven, and they wouldn't allow women to pray out loud in front of men. Women couldn't be ushers. They were biblical literalists. It was an interesting way to grow up. And so one of the problems for me is that with being born into that tradition is that I was actually born me with my I didn't manage to sort of muster up my personality in the past 10 years. Like, I was kind of born like this. And so that became a little difficult to be in a church like that. And so I left when I was 16. And when I left the church, it wasn't just that I thought, oh, I'm not interested in going to church. I actually kind of hated Christianity. So for about 10 years, I wouldn't have anything to do with the church. And instead, I developed a really small drug and alcohol addiction. Just a pesky little thing. And so I was definitely on the path of sort of just destroying myself and with drugs and alcohol. And what happened was I got clean. And it was like 17 and a half years ago at this point. But when I got clean, it really was as though God interrupted my life and said, yeah, that's adorable that you're trying to kill yourself, but I'm going to take you off of that path, and I'm going to put you on another path. And really, the grace of God was absolutely the only explanation I had for this happening in my life, because if I could have pulled myself up by my spiritual bootstraps, I'd have done that. I wasn't able to do that. And so it really felt like God had done something for me, had interrupted my life, done something for me that I absolutely could not do for myself. Now, during this time, I was also trying to be a Unitarian, which is adorable, but I couldn't pull it off. But see, when you're a church person, like when you're raised a church, like I went three times a week for 16 years, when you're raised a church person, it's really hard not to be a church person. So I was trying to be a Unitarian, and they're funny, hysterical, like very intelligent people. But what they don't talk about is the fact that we need God's grace. And I was so completely aware of the fact that God had interrupted my life and that I had been given this amazing grace that it became uncomfortable to be a Unitarian. So at this time, I met, I'm 6'1". I don't know. I'm very tall, and I play volleyball. And I was playing this sort of competitive pickup volleyball in Denver, and which is like the sacred breeding grounds of tall people. And so I met this really cute guy who's here somewhere, who now I've been married to for like almost 15 years, but met this really cute guy, and we went out for burritos, and he was great. I got really involved in political stuff. You know, I got arrested at the nuclear power plant, and I was always at protests and all this stuff. And so I was talking to this really cute guy, and he said, and we kind of agreed on all these social justice issues, because see, the church I was raised in didn't really care about social justice. It was just about, you know, you and your friends going to heaven because you all believe the right things. And we didn't care what was going on in the world. And so, like, when I left the church, I started caring what was going on in the world. And so I met this guy, and he had the same views about social justice. And we're sitting and we're eating burritos. And he looks at me, he goes, you know, for me, my heart for social justice is just really rooted in my Christian faith. And I looked at him, I'm like, what are you, like a unicorn? Like some mythical combination of creatures that doesn't exist in reality? You know, I had never heard of a Christian who cared about social justice. And so here's this really nice guy. And I was in therapy at the time, and I went to my therapist, and I said, well, I met this guy. He's really cute. We agree about a lot of stuff, but he's nice. And I had never gone out with my previous boyfriend. Spent 6 years in Susanville for armed robbery, which is a prison in California. Anyway, so I said, well, but he's nice, and he's a Christian. And she said, well, you know, just try it. Just try being, you know, going out with a nice guy. You know, you don't have to stick with him. And so I followed him out to California because he was a Lutheran seminary student. And I didn't know what a Lutheran was. That just sounded so exotic and kind of weird to me. But so he was a Lutheran. I thought they're like Catholic light or something. I didn't know what Lutheran was. So I follow him out to California. And on Sunday mornings, he would be going to this Lutheran church. And I would be going to the Unitarian church. And I just started hating those people at the Unitarian. I just couldn't stand them, you know. They just felt so self-absorbed. Love Unit. If you're Unitarian, God bless you. But I mean, if you can pull it off, you know, more power to you. But I couldn't do it. And so he said, well, why don't you come to this Lutheran church? And I thought, okay. So I went and I checked it out. And it's a Lutherans, if you don't know. I hear Lutherans in the UK are really conservative. So it's a very progressive denomination in the States. So Lutherans, a very liturgical type of thing. I had never experienced the liturgy in my life. And I go into this parish, it's St. Paul Lutheran Church in Oakland, California. You walk into this church, it's like the kingdom of heaven in there. There's like people in wheelchairs and all different colors, and there's gay people and straight people in all different ages, and it's like so full of life. And everyone's so glad to be there. And I sat there, and I experienced the liturgy, which just felt like this beautiful, mysterious thing that washed over me. And, you know, you say these things, and you do these things, and I thought, I want to go back and say those things and do those things next week. And then I thought, what are you thinking? You know, I was horrified that I even had that thought. And so, but I went back, and it ends up that there were so many unchurched people going to St. Paul Lutheran that he had an adult catechism class on Wednesday nights. And I started showing up to this class. And here's what I learned, and I felt like it changed everything. He is a completely Orthodox Lutheran pastor, and he taught me that God's grace is a gift that's freely given to us, and there's nothing we can do to earn it. It has nothing to do with our efforts or what we intellectually assent to or what good works we do. It has to do with the gracious nature of God, and it changes everything for us. And that any good works flow out of the reality of God's grace, not out of our own piety or goodness. And when he said that, I thought, I have experienced that to be true in my life. I knew here somebody was articulating something I had experienced to be true. So I did not sort of wholesale adopt some external ideology as my own. I feel like God guided me into this beautiful articulation of what I had already experienced to be true about myself and about God. Namely, that I'm a sinner and that I need God's grace and that God is gracious and merciful and abounding in steadfast love. Now, when I say I'm a sinner, that actually in my church is a term of affection. I call all my parishioners sinners just as a term of affection. So, like, if I go into a bar and they're sitting there, I'll go, "Hey, sinners," and they go, "Hey, pastor." So, it is a term of affection, but it's not a. I'm not saying, "Hey, people who are immoral," you know. It's more like saying, "Hey, people who are." Who receive God's gracious nature. God's grace flows out of the heart of God to you. So anyway, so I ended up really falling in love with the liturgy, which I felt like was this beautiful gift that had been caretaken by generations of the faithful, and it had been handed to us. And it was so mysterious, and it was like God's story and our story coming together in this beautiful way that we reenact as a community every week, and that people have been doing this for generations and generations. And I fell in love with it. And I loved Lutheran theology. Another nice nugget that we get from the Lutherans is that we're all simultaneously sinner and saint. 100% sinner and 100% saint all the time, everyone. So you're not like 80-20 some days. You're not, you know, 40-60 some days. You're 100% sinner and 100% saint. And so what becomes this sort of proclamation of good news? If you think you're only a sinner, the proclamation of good news to you is that, well, you're actually a saint. And if you think you're only a saint, the proclamation of good news to you is, well, sorry to break it to you, you're a sinner. So I loved that, and I knew it to be true. I just knew it to be true inside of me. So I became a Lutheran, and everybody who knew me started laughing. It was just like the funniest thing they'd ever heard of, that Nadia would become a Lutheran, or that she would marry a Lutheran pastor. So fast forward, raise your hand if it's going to offend you if I swear. Perfect. Okay. I went to seminary, and I'll get to that in a second, but when I was at seminary, they called me a second career student, which I thought was adorable because it implied I had a first career. But my first career was professional fuck-up, so which is surprisingly time-consuming. You'd be amazed. But I didn't go to college till I was 28. Is when I first went to college, and then my husband and I had a couple babies, and then so it took me 8 years to be in college. But it ends up that I was really good at it. It was like the first thing I was good at. I had no idea, but apparently I'm good at academics. So I got I wanted to study religion because I got my degree in religion, and then I was going to go to seminary, and they gave me this full fellowship and a stipend to do academic work, and I was all set and ready to go, and I started studying the emerging church. And I studied the emerging church, and I developed relationships, and I traveled to the UK, and I went all over the States, and I visited these communities, and then I went, oh, shit. I think I'm called to be a pastor, which was just the worst thing I could think of, because I'm a terrible choice. I have a really dark past. I'm full of tattoos. I swear like a truck driver. Nothing about me says pastor. And so what happened was, here I was. I'd come into the Lutheran church, loved the liturgy, loved this theological heritage. And I looked around the churches, and I'd sit in the pew, and I'd look around. Nobody looked like me. None of my friends were there. I mean, I am native to a very particular cultural context, right? I'm native to really very urban, postmodern, young, progressive, artistic. Like, that's what I'm native to. Like, I've been, since I was 16 years old, that's where I've been. And I just found my tribe young. So when I was 12, I bought my first album, and it was the Ramones' Road to Ruin, you know? And I sat and looked at the picture of the Ramones on the back and played that album, like, over and over on my orange and white plastic Fisher-Price record player in my bedroom. And I just stare at the Ramones because I was like, they're my tribe. I just knew it, you know? So I'm native to this particular context, and nobody in my context are sitting in the pews in Lutheran churches. Now, that's not to say that the Lutheran churches are doing something wrong at all. And so I realized nobody looks like me in these churches that I absolutely love. And then I thought, crap, I think I'm called to be a pastor to my people. And so I went to my bishop's office, because, you know, denominations and bishops and stuff, They love rules, lots of rules, right? And so one of the rules is you have to go away to a Lutheran seminary. I went to a Methodist seminary. And you have to go away to a Lutheran seminary for a whole year. And then another rule is that you can't start a church until you've been in a regular parish for 3 years. And then another rule is that you have to be a vicar. You have to be an intern at a regular, normal parish for a year before you're ordained. Like, all of these rules, right? So I sat down with the bishop's office, people from the bishop's office, and I said, listen, I really feel this call, and I think that that I want to do this thing, But I'm not going to leave my family for a year. And they said, okay, we'll figure that out. And I said, well, and I think I should really start an emerging church right out of seminary. And they said, okay, we'll work that out. And I went, shit, okay. So then I went to my seminary and I said, listen, I know you gave me all this funding. You've been very generous. You gave me all this funding to do academic work. But I think I'm going to change to a ministerial degree, and I need to know how that's going to affect my funding. And they said, you know, we'll just keep your funding in place as long as you're working on whatever degree you want to do. And I thought, shit. So then I thought, okay, well, now I have to do this. So that's the story of how I decided that I was going to start this church. So this is what I've discovered. It's been a few years since that. And I'm going to describe my community a little bit, and I'm going to talk about why I think it's great to be emerging and denominational, and then I'm just going to take questions. So this community is mainly people between the ages of 20 and 42. There's this one guy who's 70 who we love who comes. And then about 20% of them are Lutheran. So a lot of post-evangelicals. I'd say probably 75-80% of the people weren't attending church on a regular basis when they started coming. Okay. Now, so it's an ELCA church. So what they did is they let me, as my internship, start a congregation, which they have never, ever done in the history of this denomination. So they broke all these rules. They said, we think that we should let her do this. So as my internship, I started a congregation. Then I was ordained to be their pastor when that 10 months was over. So what has happened is all these people have come, and we have this church, and not many of them are Lutheran. And last week I preached a sermon in which there was a... Now, I'm an ordained ELCA pastor, and I'm preaching to my congregation, and I used the phrase, my denomination, when I was telling them something that happened at the church-wide assembly. Because they're not... I'm not making new Lutherans, right? I'm not making new Lutherans. And I was really clear about that to the bishop, that if we're going to do this, it's not about increasing our market share. We're not making new Lutherans. We're proclaiming the gospel, and we're gathering around word and sacrament, and we're doing that as a community, and they're going to do that with a pastor who's a Lutheran. And they were really clear, and they said, you know what? We're on board. That's great. This isn't about market share. So the great thing about this, which a lot of other emerging churches don't have, is my denomination said, listen, we don't have a presence in that context. The Lutheran church is not in that context. And so we want to do what we can to make sure that there's word and sacrament ministry in a context that we aren't in. So instead of these other congregations saying, well, what religious let's do some market research for this group that's not in our church, and let's figure out what religious product that we can produce that they will then come and consume, and then they'll be part of the Borg. I don't know if you're into Star Trek, but you know, then they will come and be part of us. You know, that idea of what can we do to make them come and be part of us. And so I'm like, well, what if instead of saying that, what if we go and say, hey, you people, you know what, you are the church. Now get busy. What's it going to look like? Here's a pastor. Go. So it was more of that. So this community was created by 9 people came together. And for 9 months, we ate meals together and prayed together. And what we did in this process was we said, what characterizes us and the people in our context, right? What is it about us that makes us unique from like a suburban context or rural or whatever? And we came up with a list. Now that list is going to be different no matter where you are. But for us, we said we are urban dwellers who are glad we don't live anywhere close to something like TGI Fridays. Do you guys have those? Or like Applebee's, these terrible chain restaurants. So like we're urban, we're kind of over-educated, voluntarily poor, you know, we're... our cynicism often hides a hope that's often in us. Like, we have all of these things that sort of characterize our friends and us. And then we said, well, then what does it look like to be church, like, if as these people? And we kind of started from there. So one of the great things is that I have this tradition that I come from, and I'm a completely Orthodox Lutheran theologian. And so I have a very, very particular theological standpoint that I always preach from. But then people who are in the community believe all kinds of stuff. There are people who are kind of more Baptist, and there are people who are agnostic, and they believe all sorts of stuff. But we're gathered as a community around the gospel and around the sacraments. And so we're just in this very clunky way trying to figure out how to do that. But the great thing is that we get emails all the time from people, because we put stuff up on the internet, these crazy things we do during liturgy or the Maundy Thursday, whatever. We have all this kind of really creative stuff we do with the tradition, right? Or these prayers we write or whatever. And we get all these emails from traditional Lutheran communities who say, oh my gosh, thank you. It makes me feel like there's hope for this tradition, or I'm going to take that and use it and see if it works in my context. So one of the beautiful things about denominations having these innovative communities on the edges is that it really does reinvigorate the tradition. And so I really believe that denominations, if they only focus on the core, you know, their core constituency, you know, the old people who tithe and the people who, you know, all of that. Like, if you only focus on this, right, it's going to die. And if you only focus on the edges, it's going to die. But if we have, but if we allow ourselves to say both are important, both the core and the tradition are important and the innovative edges are important, then there are ways in which both can feed each other and keep this thing going and keep it alive. So that has been my experience. And I don't know if you guys know who Tony Jones and Doug Padgett are. They're emerging church people in the States. Are people familiar with them a little bit? Emergent Village. Well, they're good friends of mine. I love them, but they're wrong. And so one of the many things that these two friends of mine are wrong about is they really feel like, you know what, you can't be missional and be tied to the dead weight of a denomination. You know, they're like, we just need to cut ties. And in an interview I was doing yesterday, someone said something like, well, do you think that the emerging church is just going to become its own denomination? I was like, I have never heard of a worse idea in my entire life than the emerging church becoming a denomination. It's like me telling my 10-year-old to be their own parent, you know? It's the worst idea I've ever heard of. And I also think it's a bad idea for the traditional church to exist without the emerging expressions of it. So they also believe that, like, ordination's not important, you know? And here's what they do. They're post-evangelicals, and God bless them. They quote Luther to me. Adorable. So they say, well, you know, radical priesthood of all believers, you know, they say, we don't need the one person who's ontologically different, you know, who's really special. And that just has not been my experience in the community. And it's not because, well, I'm the special one who gets to do the magic and, like, God loves me best and, you know, all of that. But it has to do, and I was talking about this in a panel yesterday, to me it has to do with the fact that since I'm the one who's ordained in the community, in a particular denomination, it means that I'm actually not free to do certain things, right? I'm now not free to point to anything but the cross. So, you know, I am ordered to preach Christ and Him crucified. I'm ordered to do that, right? Now, I'm not free to preach something else, right? I'm not free to have conversations and then chat about them later with other people. You know, there are things in which there's one person in the community who keeps us on the yellow brick road and keeps the focus in the place that they're ordered to keep the focus. So it's not being ontologically special, and my parishioners are over here and they'll tell you I'm not. So, but it, but I don't believe that emerging church is this sort of everything is completely flat and we don't need the pastor, we don't need the denomination. My experience has been that that it has enriched having this crazy, creative little emerging church to be attached to a denomination, to have somebody who's ordained who plays that role. So, okay, I'm going to stop gabbing, but I really want to take questions from people.
We have the microphone here. It would be great if you didn't mind to come and ask your question through the microphone so that everyone else can hear it too. So
or you can whisper your question into your extroverted friend's ear and ask them to ask it. So.
I'm a denominational pastor and planted emerging church. And one of the things I find challenging or unhelpful is the unhelpful power dynamic between not particularly the denomination but the mother church that have planted us and us, because they hold the money, they are the parent, they have this kind of knowledge and experience. And
that's right. I've been, nobody's looked over my shoulder during this process, because I think, you know, part of it is that the thing that's really important to Lutherans is theology. And so I think they trusted my, I have a really good theological education, and they trust me as a theologian. And because they trust me as a theologian, they let me, they trust me to do what I think will be right in my context. And so if anybody's here is part of like a synod or a diocese or higher up, here's what I have to say. Find people who you trust, educate them in your tradition, teach them all the best stuff, and then let them go. Find them, give them money, like find them, trust them, give them money to do this thing, and then trust them after you give them the money. Because that happens a lot too. They'll say, "Oh, we're going to fund this thing," and then they stop trusting the person. And then maybe this community does something that feels really irreverent to them, and they question their orthodoxy and pull their funding. I've seen that too. That's the other thing, is like, you know, there's stuff that goes on in our community that would be absolutely inappropriate for other churches, but it's right for us. Like our logo looks like a piece of parchment with a nail at the top, like Martin Luther, 95 Theses, right? I have to get my Lutheran stuff in where I can, because my church isn't very Lutheran. So the logo is a piece of parchment with a nail at the top, House for All Sinners and Saints. The back of the shirt says, "Radical Protestants nailing shit to the church door since 1517, right? Okay. So for our church, that's completely appropriate, because the people are really hilarious and this incredible blend of being reverent and irreverent. Now, is that going to work in like a small town parish? Probably not. But if the bishop came and said, you know, we don't really like that you, and there's an asterisk for the I in shit. So, I mean, we, you know, tried, but like if the bishop said, you know, that's just really not appropriate. You know what's not appropriate? Petty piety that gets in the way of mission. That's not appropriate.
What you said about needing a priest, I actually disagree with you, and probably lots of people do here, but maybe not. But I think what I found in experience is things like conversations, that you do invest trust in different people at different times in conversations, and people gain sort of authority through that investment of trust, through experience. And I think a priest is a little too fixed in my experience. And some priests are great, some priests aren't. But I think a more fluid model, which can embrace kind of investing trust and then stepping aside and different people taking the mantle at different stages and using different gifts in different ways.
Yeah, I appreciate you said that. I don't think it's the pastor's job to be the one person who keeps people's confidences. I think that's delusional. But I think that having one person who's actually ordered to do certain things is a good function to have within the community. And guys from my church, if you guys want to come in and address any of the questions, please do, because I'm not always the best person to ask, because I can really be full of it. So, but I appreciate that. You know, in some communities, I think they probably don't need a pastor. it works in our context. And there's, it's interesting because there's this kid who comes, he lives in this like anarchist house, and he's this crazy young kid, and we were planning a healing service. And I said, well, there are a few ways we could do it. You know, we could do it where people do the healing thing and then they turn around and do it for the next person. And then, it, you know, we could do it like that. Because we were talking about confession and healing being together. And then I said, or, you know, we could have me doing it. And he said, you know, Nadia, and this is like this anarchist kid. He goes, I really think you should do it because it's important that someone serve the priestly function within the community. And, like, I didn't expect that, you know, these postmodern, very questioning authority type of context. So, yeah.
You said you started with 9 people. Did the other 8 come to the bishop and ask for something to do, or did you go and pick them?
Did I pick them? Victoria. I really just wanted to find people who were crazy enough to do this thing with me. And I wasn't like, oh, I need to find one person who's really good with finances, and then one person who could be our poet, and then one person, you know, I didn't do that. It was more like I really trusted God would find some crazy people who would do this thing with me. Because what are you getting out of starting a church? Because you're not going to a community where something's already being provided for you. You have to put this work into creating something that you think will eventually be meeting a need of yours. Do you know what I mean? So it's a certain type of person that'll do that. So I just found people. I had a theology pub I started a few years before I started the church, met some people that way, and I kept a list of people who said they'd be interested in starting the church, and we came together, and no, the bishop didn't, they didn't find me anything. They don't do stuff for me. Yeah.
Hey, so you said that you started a church because looking around you didn't see people like you. I was wondering what you recommend if, looking around, you don't see anyone like you, but you don't feel like you're called to start a church. I wonder if you have any advice for that.
Gosh, that's a really good question. I think that you could probably start something with other people who also don't feel called to ministry and don't feel called to start something. Because I think, you know, that whole idea that God doesn't give you more than you can bear, that's actually like a plural you, so it's the whole community. So I think that it's possible to start community without being someone who starts community. Do you know what I mean? So I think that when you get people together, what can happen is more than what one individual could do. Because if you look at the work I've done and the hours I put in and then the gifts I might have, you add all that up, it absolutely does not equal this church. Like, it took so much more than that. And we get a lot of help from local congregations. They give us money to help us out because they really, this tradition that they're part of, they see it dying and it's very dear to them. And then they see it have new life and they really want to help us have a go at it.
I actually wondered about what you were saying about the giving the money and then stepping aside. And as you know, Nadia, that I'd been involved in starting something too. And at times in our journey, we have had that stepping aside. And it's actually felt, I mean, in some ways it's been good, but actually it's felt like neglect. Yeah. Stepping aside completely can feel like neglect. And at times we felt a bit sort of unloved and unsupported. But a loving, light touch, I think, is what we need in a sense. Yeah. And that generous support, but sort of hands off, but there. And I think now in the Church of England, we're getting that generous support. So I wondered if you could sort of explore that a bit more, really.
Well, I think what you said is fine. I think that's right, that I don't feel like the denomination's not involved in terms of telling us what to do and what not to do, but they are involved in terms of paying attention to what we're doing and celebrating things about what's happening. So we haven't felt the neglect. We actually get much more attention than we should because we're just this clunky little church that has no idea what it's doing. So, I have some friends who do this type of work who felt that neglect. Like, it's not so much that they're trusting them and letting them fly. It's more like they don't care about them and they're neglecting them. So, yeah.
Hi. We in our church, we've got emergent ministries. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about was what you were saying before about trust. because whilst the emerging ministry is very new and things are happening outside the main church, then that's fine. Then when that begins to impact on what's happening in their building and the building may be being used in a different way, we've come to a point where we're quite afraid, really, of the impact and what that will do, not only to, mainly to the building, really. And that is really scary. So it's something about how you actually engage. Well, we're engaging with people, that's great. But then how you get over the fear and how you bring everyone on board. So you've said that, you know, you've got a lot of support from the main core church. I don't know how distant they are from you, but when that's sort of in your face, in the same place, our church, I think, is struggling to think, how do we keep that trust and let God free in that, really? And how do we keep that trust?
Yeah, I think, and that's a question that comes up when congregations are like, how can we get young adults to come to our church? I want to have a T-shirt that actually says, they're not coming. But... Or they'll say, well, how can we get more people of color or whatever? And I think the next question always has to be, what are you willing to give up? Because it's not like you get to keep everything the way you like it and the way you're comfortable with, and all these people who are different than you are going to come and it's going to stay like that. So I think the question, if people are saying, how can we do something to get them to be part of us, the next question always has to be, what are you willing to give up? Yeah.
But I think part of that is happening, and it is, people are giving up. But, you know, you go so far, and then people saying, hang on.
Totally.
And that's the point, really.
Yeah.
So what happens there?
Well, this might have become obvious already. I don't actually have any answers. But but I think that scary part, where it's like, I feel like I'm losing something I don't want to lose. I think if it's possible to sit in that and not to act out of it, and to just allow, because you know what? The stranger, the neighbor, the other is going, if the Holy Spirit's working, is going to mess you up. The stranger is always going to mess you up. That's how you know the gospel is in action, right? So, but like, who wants that? Someone recently in a sermon, I quoted a friend of mine who said, comfort is not a fruit of the Holy Spirit. So, you know.
Hiya, I'm part of a very small church in London that is kind of in a position where it's thinking about how it could be more present in the community and looking at ministries and, you know, ecology and lots of different things and kind of trying to determine what the next stage is. And I was just curious if you could talk a little bit more about kind of what your church is actually doing, some of the activities that are going on, kind of what it looks like week to week, and you know, and what you think an urban London church might be able to learn from what you guys are doing and where you guys have come from.
Well, we have a weekly liturgy. It's at 5 o'clock on Sundays. It's very clunky and homespun. It's like homemade high church. That's what it feels like. But and we, every Tuesday, we have a Bible study in the basement of a bar downtown. It's called BYOB, Bring Your Own Brain Bible Study. And then we like to have signature events, which are quirky things we do in the community. So we did a blessing of the bicycles. So like a lot of people ride bikes in Denver, and so we just invited people to bring their bikes. And we did this big blessing of the bicycles outside. And you know those little tassely things that little girls have on the ends of their handlebars? We did the aspersion with that, you know, we're like the bikes, and we had a thorough, you know, we were sensing the bikes, and then we're like, well, what reading should we do? And then we thought, Ezekiel, a reading from the prophet Ezekiel, and the wheel was lifted above the people, and the people, you know, I mean, it's, you know, some people took it seriously, some people didn't, it was perfect, you know, so it's just this, but it shows the sort of character of our community. And the next thing we're doing is we're doing a film strip, film strip festival. So I've started collecting vintage film strips. Do you remember those things? You put them in, there's a big light bulb, and you put the strip of film in, and the tape goes, boop, and then you forward it, right? So I'm collecting vintage religious film strips, and then we're going to make our own soundtrack to them, and then show them in the basement of a bar. So like just these, we have these just funny things we do in the community. In terms of service, like at Maundy Thursday, after people had the individual absolution and the washing of the foot washing, one of the people in our community runs the underground needle exchange for junkies in town. And so it's illegal to exchange needles in Denver, which makes no sense. But during Maundy Thursday liturgy, we assembled bleach kits for the underground needle exchange in Denver. You know, so we're singing that song, Take, Oh, Take Me As I Am, as we're putting condoms and bleach and tourniquets in these bags in the middle of the liturgy. So, we just kind of do these quirky things. And we're in each other's lives a lot. I mean, we're around each other a lot. There are a lot of parties that people, there's lots of parties and eating together, and so it's definitely a community that people are involved in each other's lives, and it just sort of happened like that. So,
a lot of the emerging church sort of congregations and the alternative services before that have been very urban based. We're in a large village, it's quite rural. Looking at starting something within our Anglican context, what sort of advice can you give from what you've learned? That, I mean, you mentioned like meeting and eating together, all mm-hmm. that kind of thing. But what else can you pass on from your journey that would cross over into our quite different context?
I guess I would say that the questions that we asked about our context, you know, we spent a lot of time trying to characterize, because, you know, you might be doing church or community in a form that came out of a context a long time ago that's not even relevant anymore. And we just keep doing it, right? So I think really paying attention to the character of the context is important. And then that question's important. And then what answers you come up are going to be different because you're in a different context. But I also think it's essential for people to feel comfortable enough to know that they don't, this is something that I think is true of our church, that they don't have to bracket out part of who they are. They don't have to check their personality or their story or their culture at the door in order to be part of the Christian community. And so I think that that's very attractive to people. So the word authenticity is overused, but I think that if there's an authenticity to where there isn't this, you don't have to adopt a certain affect, you don't have to be nicey-nice, you don't have to, whatever, that this idea that God is gracious and merciful and loves you as you are, if that's the sort of primary message and people are allowed to be their broken, beautiful selves, then I think people are more likely to want to be a part of it. Because there's just, in Christian culture, a lot of times, it's just not the case. Everyone, you know, you have to pretend. So people don't have to pretend. I guess if somebody was really nicey-nice, they might have to pretend to be slightly cynical in our church. But
Nadia, my question, I'm a denominational minister, I work in a university chaplaincy. You kind of answered some of it already. My frustration with the denominational model is that it doesn't know how to make room for stories and for questions, and not even just make room for them, but even celebrate the messiness that life brings into a community, you know, because people come as people. And just interested in some of the way that your church has, I mean, how have you made that a culture in your church that it's okay?
That
it's okay to be messy, that it's all right to come in with your story. But more than that, how have you facilitated some of that storytelling? Because it needs sometimes some crafting to help people say what they want to say about themselves in order to feel, actually, I do belong here. There is room for me without me hiding something. And without it becoming narcissistic and a little self-serving.
I think the amount of communication that it goes on in the community and Twitter and Facebook and stuff like that facilitates some of that. We know what's going on in each other's lives because of a lot of the social networking stuff. And I think that helps. Also, we had a retreat. There were 26 people who went on a retreat this spring. And do you guys know what PBR is? Pabst Blue Ribbon. It's the worst beer in the world, but it's in these cans. It's just terrible American beer in cans. And I realized when the retreat was over, everyone's pulling out pictures, that every photograph had a can of PBR and a cigarette in it. And I'm like, okay, yeah, you can post some of those on Facebook, maybe not all of them. But on the retreat, what we did was one night we said, this is where we've been, and we told the whole story of how the community came about so that everyone's up to speed on it. And then we said, this is where we are. And we talked about the money and the budget and some of the problems and some of the things we're celebrating and that we've done well and who we are now. And then we talked about what values do we want to guide the decisions we'll make as we go into the future God has for us. And so there was this opportunity where people said, why am I here? What keeps me here? So I think that there are those opportunities for people to be engaged in that. And then we're just really in touch on the internet as well, and people are telling stories and putting stuff, writing notes on their Facebook page, and
it's courageous.
Yeah, it's courageous. Yeah, yeah. There's a. Oh, can I tell a story? How much time do we have?
Loads.
Really? Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's a great story, and then I'll get to your question. Yeah. So there's this girl, her name's Rachel, and she's a member of our community, and she's from a very conservative form of Reformed Church, Christian Reformed Church, which is a very, very conservative denomination. And so, but she's been part of our community for over a year, and it's a deeply sacramental community. The sacrament's very important to us, and we have an open table. And she went home and visited her parents recently. And she calls me. We meet Sunday night. She calls me Sunday morning, and she's crying. She can't even talk. I was like, okay, honey, just, you know, take a breath. Finally, she says, I'm at my parents' church, and I'm not allowed to take communion. And it just destroyed her. Being in this sacramental community that just loves her to pieces, it killed her. And so I talked to her for a while. And then I texted her later and I said, can I share this story with other people? So after liturgy, a bunch of us were hanging out at someone's house, and I told them about this phone call. And then without skipping a beat, another member of the community, Stuart, said, listen, we have to take her communion to the airport when she gets home. Like, I was like, oh my gosh, you're right. And so 10 o'clock at night on a Wednesday, 9 of us show up to Denver International Airport and bring her communion. And we had a sign. She got off the escalator, and it said, Rachel Pater, Child of God. And so she knew, you know, we're looking for her. And then we went and we celebrated the Eucharist as a community. We gave our sister the body and blood that she was denied earlier that week. So.
My question is just about burnout. You know, you've obviously got... I'd say probably very committed people. And how have you experienced burnout, or how do you guard against it, or that kind of thing?
Yeah. The people at my church are a little bit bossy, and so they'll you are. And so they okay. So I take Monday off, and I work a lot. I mean, I do probably work, you know, 50, 60 hours a week or something. And so I take Monday off. It's my day off. And so there's this kind of conspiracy. Like, if I forget and I send someone an email, like, oh, can you do such and such in liturgy? They send me back one that says, "How's your day off?" So they try and make sure that I don't get burnt out. And you know what? Sometimes it's hard. There's a lot to do, and sometimes I feel like I'm pastor at Church of the Holy Slacker. It's hard to kind of get people to follow through, and the people who are more the grown-ups end up doing a lot more of the work, and you know, it's definitely not perfect. But I love, somebody asked me when I was flying here, they said, oh, is it business or pleasure? And I'm like, there's not a lot of difference for me. So I guess I just love, I feel like, I honest to God feel like the luckiest person in the world to get to do what I do. And it's a lot of work, but I absolutely love it. And I try and carve out time for the family. My husband's a pastor too. But I haven't had too much burnout. But I did realize every week of vacation and every week of continuing ed this year, I've ended up preaching somewhere else. So I'm trying to stop. I'm going to try and stop doing that. But yeah.
Slightly different question, but
I loved what you said about the first time you went to a Lutheran liturgy and what the liturgy did for you and it being a glimpse of heaven. And I just wondered how, if you'd found it appropriate to preserve that in your emerging church, and if so, how?
Totally. Oh, we're very, very, very liturgical at our church, yeah. And actually, if any of you guys want to say anything, I would like it. But... or else no body of Christ for you later. No, I'm going to get pre-Reformation on you. But, okay, so we're very liturgical. And like I said, only maybe 20% of the people in the community are from a liturgical background. So for them, it's totally new. Oh, you guys have to say something. It's new to you. Say what you think of the liturgy. So... Yay! Her name's Amy Clifford. We were going to start a Facebook group that says, Amy Clifford, an inspiration to us all.
The thing that's wild to me is I grew up very conservative in the South. No liturgy at all. And we were starting to get ready for Greenbelt, and we started freaking out about, where are we going to get Sanctus bells? Incense for our liturgy, because it has so become a piece of who we are. And was so not a piece of where most of us came from. Yeah, totally. What else?
Why is it, I mean, how do you feel about the, why do you want to keep coming to a place that's
that's a huge question.
That's okay,
yeah, no.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Or repeat the question.
Why do I want to keep coming to a place that's liturgical? I mean, for me, I think it's... it's where I've seen Christ, like where I haven't before. Yeah. And just not having a lot of bells and whistles, which I was accustomed to in the past, I think makes a huge difference, because it kind of takes away some of the stuff that seems to distract.
We want to have T-shirts that say, House for All Sinners and Saints, come join us. We have absolutely nothing to offer you. Because we're not a programmatic church, and because there's absolutely no entertainment value to coming to the service. The whole liturgy is led from within the community by the community. So outside of the words of institution, the sermon, I don't actually do anything. So everybody, they stand up, they lead that part of the liturgy, they sit down, just so. No show.
I just wanted to say that I grew up in the church, in the evangelical church, and I had really come to a place a long time ago where, what is the point? That's really what I still feel about a lot of church. And the reason I continue to come back to a liturgical setting is the meaning that it brings back to me that I really didn't even grow up with. We just did most of what we did because that's what you do. And I feel like I understand more and I experience God in a much deeper way. And that's why I continue to come to it.
Jim did not want to be part of a church. He took him weeks. He was like, I'm just hanging out. He's hung out every week since the first week he came. Yeah, the liturgy is, it's transformational. It's like it provides psychic insulation against the darkness from outside and from within that I just feel like we need. I don't know how else to put it, but yeah, go ahead.
The emerging church genuinely scares a lot of mainstream churches, especially in England. I mean, years ago I was part of an alternative church based in Sheffield called the 9 o'clock service, which had huge growth, but the church gave it huge freedom, and it just, in the end, it was a monster that went out of control with sex scandals. I mean, how do you plan to keep people in your church accountable, especially the leadership, as your church grows?
Well, that's another benefit for being in a denomination. I have colleagues who are in these free evangelical churches, and one of my one of the parishioners in our community came because she the pastor from her previous church started dating her and then broke up with her. And then was baffled as to why she wouldn't come to church anymore. And then later that pastor started dating another member of the pastoral staff. Now, if I was single, either of those things would get me fired. right? I would be removed. So one of the benefits of being in a denomination to me is the fact that people are looking over your shoulder in the sense of holding you accountable in terms of ethics and stuff. And that I think when you don't have that, it can become a cult of personality really quickly. So, like, I have a really big personality, and you know what the last thing my church needs is for me, for it to be based totally on my personality, and no one else is looking out, right? I saw that in my the book that I wrote. I watched 24 consecutive hours of Trinity Broadcasting Network, which is this horrible Christian television station. It's all prosperity gospel preachers and stuff. And I'd watch these people who, it's like, it's all their charismatic personality, and that's it. They aren't accountable to anybody. So it's good for me to be accountable. It was good for me to submit to a process for ordination that was extensive. You know, it's good for me to have somebody who's in a position of authority over me, to have a bishop. What we don't need is just me on my own doing some crazy thing, you know. So accountability, it's kind of built in. At least in my denomination. There's just a lot of stuff I would never get away with that I shouldn't get away with.
My question is, I've been in an emerging church context and I'm now back in kind of more denominational environment. And one of the questions I have is, how do we in an emerging church context, instill the value that we see in the tradition in those around us to an extent that we're not, that the church is not just, or the emerging church is not just freeloading on the side, but is actually pushing value back into the core of the church and actually appreciating.
Can you say a little bit more about what you mean?
Well, I guess certainly my experience was that we were very good at receiving support from the church and from ordained members as well who were employed in other contexts. So we would receive an awful lot, but particularly financially, but in other ways, we existed in our own little bunker. So it's a case of how we can move from, if you like, pillaging the tradition, but to doing our own thing, but also supporting it.
Yeah, that's good. We do have a lot of financial help from outside. About, I would say half of the people in the community have absolutely no income because they're either full-time volunteers or they're graduate students or they're laid off. They're unemployed. And then the big breadwinners are the inner city public school teachers and the people who work for nonprofits, social workers. So it's just not a lot of money. But the ways in which I think it can give back is being that innovative edge. Because people are very inspired. For us, we're just doing this crazy thing, but other people are really inspired by it. You know, they'll take an idea and say, oh, maybe this will work in my context. Or they'll say, oh, wow, this thing is really precious to us, and now we see that it has new life over here. And it makes us, you know, Lutherans have really low self-esteem about their tradition. Like, I'll go and speak in front of Lutherans and I'll be like, I love being a Lutheran, and they look at me and they're like, really? Why? And I'm like, well, here's why. And so it's like all of a sudden they feel like there's something worthwhile about their own tradition because they see all these other people coming to it. And it's obviously Lutheran. So it's one thing I wanted to talk about as well. We talked about it being in this really particular cultural context. One of the greatest joys of my work are the people who come who aren't in that context that I never would have imagined. We have this one corporate lawyer who came. He was Buddhist until like 6 months ago, and now he's like part of our community. He's an astounding poet. And then there's this family who lives deep in the suburbs. It's called Highlands Ranch. It's like this soulless suburb of like these starter mansions that all look the same, you know. And they come from Highlands Ranch where they're very active in their Baptist church, and he's an FBI agent. So like about every 4 or 5 weeks they show up because they love it. And I'm like, never in a million years did I think that those people would like it, and they love it. And so like there's this real joy, and I love being wrong about stuff like that. And so and then another example is that We have a Lutheran campus ministry, I don't know, like for college kids, but it's really geared toward, UCLA did a study, and they said like 7 to 8% of college kids will go to school, will go to church no matter what. So like, your church can just really suck, and they're still going to come, right? So I call them the freaks, and I love the freaks. Like, some of my friends are the freaks, but they don't necessarily represent their peers culturally. You know, they're that 7% that's just going to be going to church no matter what. And so the freaks come to our church. So all these people who were, like, in Lutheran campus ministry, and they're just really nice, and they've always gone to church and all, they came because it's Lutheran, and the only other option is to go to a congregation where anybody remotely close to their age is married and having kids. And that's not where they're at. So even though we did this work about, let's be very particular about the context, we do have these people coming in who don't fit in that. And it's completely enriched the community. So. Last question. Ooh, no pressure, though.
Ooh, yeah. So I'm from Portland, Oregon, in the States, and I'm just about to start seminary, being a Presbyterian
minister.
Okay,
let's just pause for a moment of prayer right now.
When you're talking about context, I'm sort of in the situation of not exactly knowing what my context is, because when you're talking about soulless suburbs, that's where I grew up, and the church is what got me through that. But I don't really know if that's where I want to go back to. And I'm kind of wondering, like, for people that are interested in the emerging church and sort of bringing that to people, like, that was brought to me in the suburbs. Kind of, how do you figure out where your context is? How do you figure out where it is that God's calling you? Because with you, it sounds like, you know, there was that context. You saw there's no one here.
Yeah.
Kind of, what advice do you have?
I guess to pay attention to, where do you feel like you're not fractured? You know, I mean, is there a place or a context in which you feel like parts of you don't have to be bracketed out, where you don't feel like a fractured self? Then maybe that's your tribe. I guess that's the only thing I can kind of come up with. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to speak to you in this beautiful, windy day. Come visit us anytime. We have liturgy at 5:00, and it's in Denver, Colorado, on the corner of 5th and Bannock. If you ever happen to be around, please join us. And it's been an honor to be here this whole weekend. Thank you so much.